Christabel made Ediard wait. He couldn't believe it. Tradition was one thing, but he stood at the front of the ladies' church all by himself, with the far sight of the city focused on him as minute after painful, lonely minute dragged on. Tradition said the groom wasn't allowed to use his own far sight to check and see if the bride was on her way, so he just stood there and endured. The smell of pollen, sweet when he and Dinlay walked into the church, was now overpowering, threatening to make his eyes water. It seemed as if half the Iguru plain had been stripped of foliage to decorate the huge church. The band from the Musicians' Guild played on and on, repeating the same tune which had become more like a funeral dirge. As the same terrible notes began once more, he gritted his teeth, wishing he'd pleaded a lot harder with Dybal to play for him. But Dybal was only going to sing at the reception gala tonight. He shifted his weight from one foot to another. In front of him, the 30-foot-high snow marble statue of the lady gazed down benignly, her arms uplifted to summon the Sky Lords to Quirentia. The sculptor had captured a most enigmatic expression. It was almost as if she was giving her congregation a judgmental glance. Certainly, anyone standing right at the front of the pews, curiously on the exact spot he had to wait, was singled out for her disapproval. Shifting from one foot to another, he considered that she must have known that one day Ediard would be married in her church, that her time sense had warned her of the sacrilege. Why else single him out to glare at? Another lost minute. His mind began to conjure up all sorts of horrors which could have beset Christabel. He knew she'd set off from the Culverit mansion. Tradition at least allowed him that much. The same tradition which stated the bride was only allowed to change her mind between her home and the church. But Christabel wouldn't do that to him. So she could have been assassinated or kidnapped or the gondola capsized, because Christabel wouldn't abandon him. So where in Honius is she? Ediard started to cheat, using the city's senses to examine the church. Not farsight, so no breach of tradition. Damn, I even think like a lawyer now. Just about every grand family in Macathran was represented. Notable exceptions were Mistress Florel, who had announced a headache an hour before the service was due to begin and gave her apologies for non-attendance. The Gilmornes were also absent, as were the Norrets, who counted Lieutenant Eustace among their number. Captain LaRose, however, was there, and looked most amused by the water walker's discomfort. Grandmaster Owen was in the pews reserved for guild dignitaries. Losing the election didn't seem to have affected him at all. He retained his slightly cool persona throughout every encounter. Maxin and Cancine were almost invisible amid the district masters, their colourful robes blending in flawlessly. Cancine wasn't showing yet, though of late she'd started making some very barbed comments about which would arrive first, the mansion or the baby. The section reserved for the groom's family was unusually small. Christabel had appropriated several of his pews for her own family and friends. But Ediard thought he was well supported with a dozen constables, and Bijuli and Dybal, and Setasis, and Isoix, and Topar, and others he'd met during his time in the city, headed up by Mayor Finnerton himself. His one true regret was Salrana, who had sent a polite note of regret, claiming her duties wouldn't allow her to attend. She was the closest thing he had to family, but since the day of banishment they'd been completely estranged. Every attempt he'd made to be reconciled had been rebuffed. He knew she was still at the church in Isidro, devoutly fulfilling her duties. The few times he'd long-sighted her, he'd been saddened by the way the joy seemed to have gone from her life. She'd aged inexplicably, becoming withdrawn and somber. This was a cooler, more resolute Salrana. He regretted his snatched glimpses and quickly desisted. To his dismay, he had to admit that she had changed as he had. The Salrana and Ediard who lived in Ashwell were gone forever now. The sound of cheering seeped into the church, and Ediard's heart started to beat faster. Their marriage wasn't an official holiday, though there'd been a big crowd outside the church when he and Dinlay arrived. Finally, the band curtailed their wretched tune. He heard the rustle of cloth as the novice choir rose to their feet. Then the light changed perceptibly as the big doors swung open. Dinlay stepped up beside him, smiling wide. "Too late to back out now," he murmured to Ediard. Any scathing reply was lost as the organist began the wedding march. Ediard had never heard the giant keyboards being played before, The sound was overwhelming. Then the novices began their accompanying melody. He was impossibly terrified and elated at the same time. Julin appeared beside him, his pride shining with the power of a dawn sun. And she was there, at his side. Etiat nearly let out a whimper of relief. Minatha giggled at his expression. The little girl was wearing a pink and white dress that transformed her into some enchantingly sweet fairy creature, an image only spoilt when she grinned her devilsome grin. Christabel's wedding gown was a gold-cream dross-silk creation, with royal blue trimming that twinkled with emerald gem flowers. Its train seemed to stretch back halfway down the aisle. He saw her head turn inside the veil, her eyes shining through the lace. Then the Pythia was standing in front of them, her smile gentle and commanding. The organist ended his thunderous anthem. "Welcome to you all, on this happiest of days," the Pythia said to the congregation. Julin and Christabel lifted the veil from her face. Her hair flowed out like ripples of gold silk. Etiat couldn't believe anyone so perfect was facing him at his own wedding ceremony. This surely must be some dazed fantasy from his last night in Ashwell, a moment of blissful delusion after the bullet struck and before death. Christabel took both his hands in hers and squeezed reassuringly. "Been waiting long?" she teased. "My whole life," he told her truthfully. They honeymooned at the Culverit family's Mer-Oak Lodge on the coast, spending half a month there by themselves. 20 days of delight. A lot more staff accompanied them this time, providing them with excellent meals and unobtrusive service. The end of summer was approaching, but it was still hot. Humid air above the cove barely moved the whole time they were there. As before, they took lazy walks along the coast, swam in warm water and sunned themselves on the beach until both of them had tanned a deep honey brown. Etiat tried his hand at fishing, but lacked the patience. Both of them learned to sail in a small yacht that was a wedding gift from Chariao. They even managed a couple of trips sailing to nearby fishing villages in thankfully calm waters. "I think it will be some time before we venture that circumnavigation I mentioned," Etiat admitted the evening after their first big voyage 2 miles along the shore. On the other side of the table, Christabel laughed agreement, backdropped by a golden blaze of the setting sun. Both of them were determined from the outset to have the time for themselves. They avoided talking about city life and its politics. Too much of the last 4 months had been spent establishing Finnerton as the mayor, persuading the old guard to adopt his consolidation policies, strengthening the judiciary, and reinforcing the determination and effectiveness of the constables. It seemed to be working. Everyone reported good business. With the shadow of fear and uncertainty lifted, people were spending with confidence again. Finnerton's first few months were already judged a success. In Macathran, out in the provinces, things were not so agreeable. The news Topar had brought back at the start of the year was becoming common knowledge. Even his ominous predictions now seemed optimistic. Bandits, so long confined to the westernmost provinces, were making long inroads to the east. Back in the springtime, Rulan province faced a huge ongoing exodus as raids became a weekly occurrence. Then Warfolk province reported caravans being ambushed on previously safe highways. The numerous mountains of the interior were ideal refuges for the roaming bands to strike at villages and towns. After a raid, they would ride into the tricky, inhospitable terrain and vanish from the sheriffs and militiamen sent to hunt them. What worried Etiat most was the long distance these episodes occurred at. Macafan only ever got to hear of a bandit incident months after it actually happened. They had no idea what was currently going on beyond the Iguru Plain, how close the raiders were venturing to the city. A mere 2 months after the election, the first refugees from the Ulfsen Mountains had trickled into Macathran, whispering about strange, powerful guns, guns that could defeat an entire cavalry platoon. Official casualties from the militia regiments Owen had dispatched to help the governors began to rise. People started to notice the number of lavish memorial services which grand families threw for the officers increased sharply. Nobody blamed Finnerton, but he was starting to face questions about what he intended to do about the worsening circumstances out beyond the Iguru Plain. All that, Etiat had put behind him in favor of sunny days lounging on the sands drinking cool wine. and equally hot nights making love to Christabel. Then the day came when the staff and G-monkeys packed the huge pile of bags and crates, and they began the carriage journey home. He fell silent as they trundled along the broad coastal road, contemplating what news he would be accosted with as soon as they reached the city once again. "You'll still have me," Christabel said adamantly. Ediard broke out of his reverie. "Huh? You haven't spoken a word for the last 2 miles. Was it that horrible a time?" "No, that's the problem. I wish it could have gone on and on. There's a big part of me that doesn't want to go back." "Me too." She attempted a smile, but her usual contentment was missing. "I don't think I'm pregnant yet." "Ah. They say Vinac juice lingers in the blood for a while after you stop taking it. Another month would see it gone, and us successful." He put his arms around her. "I promise to redouble my efforts when we get home." He stopped abruptly, then smiled. "Home." "Yes," she said with equal glee. "The two of us together." "Alone, apart from your family and 200 servants. But what the honius? We'll try and make the best of it." Her third hand pinched him hard. "You feel so guilty about that, don't you?" "Not guilty, just unaccustomed to it." He remembered what Cancine had said on the balcony of B's bottle. "I'm sure I'll get used to it eventually. It can't be that difficult." "You know, if Finnerton had lost, I really would have followed you to a village on the edge of the wilds." He kissed her, and Manartha would have become mistress of Haxpen. "Oh, lady." Christabel's hand flew to her mouth. "I never thought of that. Off to the wilds by yourself you go, then." They clasped each other tighter. "I wanted to be pregnant," she said. "It would be so nice for Cancine's boy to have a playmate. Our children would grow up together."
"Cancine still has another month and a half to go, and you will be pregnant many times. Our children will play with those of the Sampaloc master's family."
She nodded, allowing him to convince her. "What will happen with the bandits in the provinces?" He sighed. "I don't know. We still don't know where they get their weapons from. That's the true cause of all this strife."
"Finnerton's going to ask you to go out there, isn't he?"
"Probably."
"You must go if it's the right thing."
"I don't want to leave you."
"I know. But Ediard, don't you want our children to live in a safe world?"
"Of course."
"So really there's no choice to be made, is there?"
Ediard said nothing. She was right, of course, which made arguing futile. Given the path he'd chosen for himself, some events were inevitable. At least nothing about the city had changed when they got back. The carriage and horses were led away to the Culverit stables in Tycho, and they took the family gondola back to the Ziggurat mansion. Julin and Manartha were waiting for them on the mooring platform, both equally excited.
"I missed you so," Manartha squealed, hugging her sister.
"And I you," Christabel promised.
"What was it like?"
Ediard and Christabel managed to avoid looking at each other.
"A nice restful holiday," Christabel explained to her little sister. "Really? I always get fearfully bored after just one day at the lodge. What did you do all that time?"
She gave Ediard a wide-eyed look of innocent interest. It didn't fool him for a second. Julin cleared his throat. "Shall we go and inspect the 10th floor now?" The staff and G-monkeys had been extremely busy since the wedding. Christabel's agonized rearrangement of the family had been implemented, with everyone shifting apartments and floors. In the end, 14 sets of relatives had moved out, more than originally intended, but there were a lot of new marriages planned amid the relatives occupying the 5th and 7th floors, which would create another accommodation shortage over the next couple of years. Some of the third-floor families decided not to wait. Julin had offered to build them new manor houses on lands the Culverits owned beyond the Iguru. In all honesty, Ediard didn't see a lot of change to the furniture and fittings on the 10th floor. The big lounges and reception rooms were the same as before, with all the family's artwork and antiques in the same positions they'd occupied for centuries. He and Christabel would take over the master's suite from Julin, which had been decluttered. He made no comment on the standard Macathran bed and bathing pool. They could be reshaped easily enough. His few possessions from the maisonette were standing forlornly in one of the empty studies.
When he looked at the small pile of boxes in comparison to everything the Culverites had accumulated over 2 millennia, he began to feel intimidated by the family again. "You'll soon make it your own," Julin said comfortingly as he caught sight of Ediard's expression. "Yes, sir."
"I got Uncle Dagnall's old chambers," Manartha said joyfully, "and Daddy said I could have new furniture and curtains and everything."
"Within reason," Julin said hurriedly.
"Come and show us then," Christabel said, holding out a hand.
Ediard followed the sisters out of the master suite, taking one last look at the main octagonal bedroom with its huge circular bed. The room was bare apart from a fluffy brown carpet, some plain wardrobes and chests. The dressing room next door contained all of Christabel's clothes. He couldn't help but compare its simplicity to the way Christabel had decorated her bachelorette room just down the hall. "Perhaps she'll allow me some say in how we make our bedroom look. I could offer to craft her a shower and a proper toilet, make the light white." The idea of spending the next 200 years sleeping in anything as fluffy as she'd created before was unnerving. They spent the afternoon with the 10th floor's housekeeper discussing further changes. Several master carpenters were summoned to prepare drawings of the furniture Christabel wanted to commission. Ediard was relieved when she toned down the drapes and fittings for their bedroom, and finally found the courage to volunteer his own alterations. The craftsman tried not to be too obvious, listening when he explained how the shower could go anywhere and be any size. In fact, altering the whole layout of the 10th floor would be a simple matter for him, if she was just prepared to wait while the walls adjusted themselves. Christabel sent everyone away when he started explaining that.
"I'd never thought of altering things on that scale," she admitted. "Nothing ever changes in Macathran."
"It can now." He looked round the big lounge they were in. "In fact, how about some more windows in this place? Let some light in."
"What about the main stairs?" she said excitedly. "Can you change them? The ones in Cancine's new mansion are actually usable."
"I thought you'd never ask." Julin and Manartha were noticeably absent from supper on the 10th floor hortus that evening, making a big show of saying how much they wanted to eat with the 9th floor families.
"It'll never last," Christabel said as they sipped some sparkling white wine under a big white gauze awning. Long candles had been lit among the pots of orchids and troughs full of huge evening glories. With the orange lights of the city starting to twinkle amid the twilight and lengthening shadows, Ediard couldn't imagine a more romantic setting. Neither, it seemed, could a lot of Macathran's citizens. They both had to cast a seclusion haze to ward off curious farsights.
"But we can make the most of it for a couple more days," he said. It was almost a plea.
"You have to go back to Jeevan Station tomorrow. You're its captain after all. And Finnerton will want to talk to you, and Maxon is going to have 12 problems.
"I know. They've been very polite not calling us today."
"I did long talk Camseen earlier. She says the mansion's almost complete, as far as she can tell. She wants you to confirm it's finished growing so she can start ordering fittings and fabrics for it."
"Okay," he said reluctantly. "I'll check tomorrow." Her hand came down on top of his. "We still have tonight. And every night."
"You know what I mean. Tomorrow our new lives really begin."
"I know.
But that's ours yet."
When Ediard walked into the Jeevan station first thing the next morning, he found Dinlay had coped admirably during his absence. He was almost peeved at that, but you couldn't argue with paperwork, and Dinlay had been quite meticulous about recording everything. Glancing at the new charts hanging up in his office, Ediard saw that patrols had gone out on time, duty rosters were made up, monies allocated and spent, timetables established. Arrests had been made, but these days the constables tended to issue cautions to any miscreants they found. It was often enough. Only the most committed recidivists were hauled up in front of the judges now. Probationer training was also going well. Even Markol was expected to pass his exams in time for graduation next month.
"Though it's touch and go," Dinlay admitted. "There's a sweep if you want to put some money down."
"I don't think that would be proper," Ediard said. It wasn't quite the comment he expected from Dinlay, but he couldn't find fault in any other way. "So what else has been happening?"
"It's been quiet, actually, in the city at least. We're still getting refugees arriving, which is causing a lot of talk about how the remaining empty buildings are being taken up. people were expecting their children to move into the available places.
Do we know how much spare housing there is? I mean, is this going to be a problem?
I expect the Guild of Clerks know the true numbers.
I'm sure they do. They seem to know everything else.
And anyway, it's Finnerton's problem, isn't it?
Yes, you're right. Ediard sat behind the desk he'd inherited from Ronark. Like the office, it was dark and functional. To be honest, a little bit drab and depressing for his taste.
He looked round at the high, slightly curved walls with their small oval windows. No wonder it was so gloomy. The city fabric was a grungy brown with strange vertical vermilion streaks, as if someone had spilt colouring dye down them a long time ago.
Dinlay left to lead a squad on patrol. Ediard began reviewing the station logs. It was no good. The office just kept distracting him. He reached down to the city's thoughts and made some suggestions for modification.
Expanding the windows, changing the wall colours to a pleasant pale sky blue, adapting the lighting rosettes to shine white, much the same as he'd done to the 10th floor of the Calverit Mansion this morning. Here the changes would be finished within a week. Back home it would take longer. Christabel was still toying with the idea of changing the entire layout. Even after he'd kicked off the office changes, the logs didn't interest him. He let his farsight reach out to the Orchard Palace.
"I wondered how long it would take you," Finnerton said.
The oval sanctum hadn't changed. Ediard had expected Finnerton to stamp his mark immediately, but the week after the election Finnerton had remarked that he had more important things to worry about than the furniture, so the huge desk was still there in the middle, its dark veneer gloss to a mirror shine. The high velvet padded chair behind it was Owen's relic too, but Ediard did recognize the silver cups that the G-chimps poured his tea into, and Owen hadn't used Genistars in here. Finnerton had brought the Genistar egg cradle from his office in the Blue Tower, but it sat on his desk empty. Topar took a seat next to Ediard, refusing a cup of tea.
"Well," Finnerton started, "we managed to survive an entire 20 days without you."
"Yes, sir," Ediard said.
"The city isn't really a problem anymore. People seem to have accepted my term without too much resistance."
"They certainly have. Christabel is complaining about how long the furniture she commissioned will take to build. The craftsmen are run off their feet right now. It's the same all across Macathran. People are spending their money again. They have confidence in you, sir."
"My apologies to your wife."
Finnerton put his cup down and gave Ediard an uncomfortable stare. "Unfortunately, the city's current bout of good fortune isn't being repeated beyond the Iguru Plain."
Ediard gave a short nod. "I know."
Topar cast out a strong seclusion haze.
"I've been sending scouts out into the provinces," he said. "Good men, ex-constables, sheriffs, even a few reserve officers from the militia. People who know how to look after themselves. People I can rely on."
"We wanted to build up a picture of these damn raids," Finnerton said. "See if there was a pattern behind them. A purpose."
"That's where it gets strange," Topar said. "If they're trying to soften us up for an invasion, they're going about it in a very odd way. There have been no bandit raids at all in the Rulan province since midsummer. In fact, the west seems clear of all disturbances. They've moved steadily east through the three largest mountain ranges, causing a lot of damage and setting light to a wildfire of fear and rumor. In fact, that's our worst enemy right now. Any dispute that results in violence is attributed to bandit raids, from landowners fighting with poachers to a tavern brawl, so bad is their reputation. It's hard to determine what's real and what isn't. The provincial governors aren't reliable at the best of times. Now any trifling squabble is seen as an excuse to petition Macathran for militia support."
"It doesn't help that Owen sent the regiments out so willingly before," Topar said. "Expectations of support were set too high."
"He's left you a real mess," Ediard said.
"Yes. That's politics and to be expected. But we took a very good look at the information we can confirm. It's a worrying result."
"In what way?"
"Basically, we've established there are 6 main packs of bandits," Topar said. 2 are heading along the Ulfsen Mountains. 1 is using the Comanza Range for cover. 2 started out in the Gorgian Mountains, though one of those is now heading northeast along the Yorans. and the last is plaguing the Sastairs all the way down to the southern coastal provinces. Edyard closed his eyes, trying to picture what he'd just been told on a map of the known lands. They're stretched quite thin, then.
I prefer the term widespread, Topar said. We're a basically peaceful society, and their physical impact is minimal given the size of the areas concerned, but the disturbance and worry they cause is near universal.
So what are they doing?
One last thing.
Finnerton pulled a piece of paper across the desk and started to read.
In Plax province, there were raids on Payern, Orastrul, Oki, Bihak, and Tikrit, all villages or small towns. The manor houses and their lands at Stonyford, Turnditch, Uxmal, Saltmarsh, Clongsop, Ettrick, and Castlebay have also suffered extensive damage during the last 2 months.
He gave Edyard an expectant look.
Anything ring a bell?
I've heard of the Uxmal Manor, the culverts own it. I think it's a big parkland holding. They raise sheep there. He had a nasty feeling one of the families from the third floor had gone there to make their new home.
Indeed, every one of those estates belongs to an ally of mine, Finnerton said. Allies and supporters also have considerable assets in or around the targeted villages.
Edyard felt cold. How could the bandits know that?
Somebody told them, Topar said. Someone who has conducted a comprehensive search through the official treasury registry.
It took us a while to work it out, Finnerton said. Everyone I met at a party or dinner was complaining about their losses. I heard nothing else. I thought the invasion had already begun until I realized my allies were being singled out.
Lady.
Which brings us back to the question of who are they and what are they doing?
They must have collaborators in the city, a shocked Edyard said.
At the very least, Topar said.
He exchanged a worried glance with Finnerton. There's also the question of the guns. If there isn't another city equal to us.
No, Edyard said. The Weapons Guild. They had the long barrel pistols all this time, but whoever supplied the bandits with repeat-fire guns killed Ashwell.
Too early to make that accusation, Topar said abruptly, and we have no proof whatsoever.
This is why we ask you in, Finnerton said. I know a lot of your power comes from whatever relationship you have with the city itself, but you still have the strongest psychic ability I have ever known.
A week ago a report came in of a raid on Northford, Topar said. That's a village in the Donsori Mountains, Edyard. Just 4 days' ride from Macathran, for the lady's sake. Rapid-fire guns were used. We know that for a fact. One of the Elfson Mountain groups must have pushed eastwards in the last month.
If we can capture one of them alive, Finnerton said, we might just be able to find out what exactly is going on, who those collaborators are.
I'm going to take a small group of the best people I know and trust, Topar said. We'll have G-Eagles and G-Wolves, and the best pistols available. Even so, I could do with some help.
Oh, lady. Edyard put his cold teacup back on the desk. When do we leave?
Despite all he'd been through in Macathran, the city had made him soft, Edyard acknowledged on the second day. An easy life was an easy trap to fall into. Life on the road was a sharp reminder of the way he used to live. Making camp each night, looking after the Genistars himself rather than asking a servant, collecting wood to make a fire, cooking his own food, sleeping under a blanket and an oilskin beneath the nebula-swathed sky. That was cold enough. Then after the third day, they didn't even have a fire for fear the bandit crew would notice it, and they were high in the Donsori Mountains by then. But at that, he did better than Dinlay and Maxon. They were real city boys, so he alleviated his own discomfort by enjoying theirs. Their third night out from Northgate, they camped on the side of Mount Io, half a day's ride from the main road through the mountains. There was still a lot of traffic on the road, with caravans and wagons and carriages rattling along the broad paved slabs that switchbacked along the rugged slopes. But all of them were accompanied by packs of G-wolves. The wealthier travellers had their own guards as well. There were also daily patrols of local militia squads. Edyard's own party went under the guise of trading guildsmen, a common enough sight on the roads. As well as himself and Topar, they had Bolaton,
an ex-sheriff from Oki who had spent over half his 70 years roaming across the countryside. The second of Topar's companions was Fresedge, a huge man whose bulk was mostly muscle, another outdoors type who had seen membership in a southern provincial militia, as well as serving 10 years as a coastal warden. In turn, he was good friends with Verini, born to a caravan family, who was taking a decade-long break from the eternal trade routes to scout round new markets and learn the roads in different territories. Then there was Larby, who had the manners of a grand family son, yet was clearly comfortable with road life, and proficient with a pistol. He said little about his background, but Ediard suspected he had been affiliated to the families in a fashion not too dissimilar to Argian. That just left Dinlay and Maxon to complete their number. By the end of the first day, Saddle saw himself, Ediard was beginning to think he shouldn't have asked them along. Maxon had proved particularly difficult to convince. He was naturally concerned for Cancine, who was due in just a few weeks. However, they stuck it out and learned from the others quickly enough. That they'd adapt was never Ediard's concern. His main worry was that the three of them would be absent from Macathran at the same time. Such a thing would be noticeable to a suspicious mind. If there was someone in the senior ranks of government collaborating with the bandits, they might raise a warning, even though they'd never know exactly what to warn against. And it would be difficult getting word out here ahead of Topar's group. As their party progressed, their main source of information was fellow travelers. They didn't even have to ask difficult questions. Those who used the road frequently were unrivaled gossips. Rumor of a bandit crew was strong. There had been another raid after Northford, at a hamlet called Regent Fleet. 5 families dead and the buildings torched. The local governor was demanding assistance from Macathran's militia regiments to catch the bandits. Regent Fleet was uncomfortably close to Sandmarket, the provincial capital. "They're heading south, then," Topar said when they first heard the news of Regent Fleet, which is why they eventually left the main road to strike out across the high terrain by themselves. It was hard going, even for the stoic G-horses, a type which blended traits of high endurance with speed. Not as fast as terrestrial horses. They still had the stamina to keep a fair pace going, even on the rocky slopes away from the road. Topar led them along the edge of the woodlands which dominated the middle slopes. Thick forests of tall, spindly, calcined trees, whose feathery blue-gold fronds spent the winter months curled up in tight walls. They made camp that third day under overhanging branches, which dripped an unpleasant waxy sap from their newly budded scarlet spore cones. A small stream trickled along one side, allowing the horses and G-wolves to drink. That night they sent their G-eagles roving around the peaks and swooping through the valleys. The big birds had a trait Ediard had never known of before, a near-perfect night sight. There were no colors to the vision he received from them. The world they flew over was drawn in shades of gray, but still the features were sharp and true. Ediard could see small creatures scuttling along, oblivious to the birds gliding silently overhead.
"You're still young. You can still become an apprentice to the Blue Tower yet," Topar taunted when Ediard remarked upon the trait.
Like the Weapons Guild, the Masters of the Blue Tower kept secrets that might work to their advantage. The G-Eagles found nothing that night. Topar and Ediard called them back in the early hours to rest before breaking camp early the next day. Ediard woke to the sound of Dinlay cursing heavily, hopping about on one foot as he held his other boot high. His glasses were still on the roll he used as a pillow, so his face was screwed up as he squinted at the boot.
"Lady, damn it!"
Everyone else was lifting their heads, using farsight to scan round, anxious they'd been discovered. Everyone apart from Maxon, who was on watch. He was unperturbed, just sitting on an old fallen trunk watching Dinlay with cool amusement.
"Bloody Honius!"
Dinlay took a bad hop backwards and tripped on a small rock. He landed hard on his arse and let out a distressed grunt. Ediard winced in sympathy as the flare of pain burst out of his friend's mind.
"What? What?"
Dinlay spluttered.
"You're okay back there?"
Maxon called in a voice that was far too calm. It triggered a suspicious grin on Ediard's face. When he pushed his farsight into Dinlay's boot, he found a mush in the toe that had been a Utog beetle, a native insect with a particularly prickly carapace.
"Did you?"
an outraged Dinlay gasped.
"Was that you?"
"Me what?"
Maxon replied innocently. The others were chuckling now as Dinlay started shivering, partly from the bruise on his buttocks and partly from the cold. He was dressed only in a thin shirt and cotton undertrousers.
"May the lady crap on you from a great height," Dinlay muttered darkly.
His third hand pulled his glasses onto his face, then began scraping the squashed remains of the beetle out of his boot.
"Children, children," Fressage said with a shake of his head.
He pushed his blanket back and rose ponderously, flexing his arms to work out the knots earned from sleeping on rough ground. Ediard pulled on a thick sweater of his own and clambered to his feet. He never could get comfortable just lying on the ground. A careful farsight examination of his own boots revealed they were unused by nesting insects, and he pulled them on. Topar had snatched up a pistol as soon as he'd woken. Now he gave Maxen a disapproving glance and clicked the safety catch back on. Bolaton and Larby started rolling up their sleeping blankets. Now his boot was clean, Dinlay transferred his attention to his toe. Several Utog spikes were sticking through his woolen socks. He removed them one at a time.
"Well done," Ediard said to Maxen, "just how I envisaged a district master would behave."
Verini was grinning along with the rest of them.
"How did you three ever clear the city of gangs?" he mused quietly.
Maxon flashed Ediard a profoundly guilty smirk.
"You're so pathetic," Dinlay grumbled.
"Got to do something to stay awake,"
Maxon murmured. He pulled a kettle off the little stove that burned Jamalar oil. "Tea, anyone?"
"You do have a use," Fressage mocked.
"Few and far between, but those I have I excel at."
Ediard and Dinlay exchanged a look.
"Not what Cancine says," Dinlay said smugly, and pulled his boot on.
Ediard took his cup over to Maxon. "You're an ass," he said, grinning as his friend poured out the boiling water.
"Yep, and that's just on the plus side."
Ediard stirred in one of the hand-tied linen tea packets which the 10th-floor housekeeper had made up for him. The others had ribbed him mercilessly about those, but they wound up borrowing them at every meal.
"How much longer is this going to take?" Dinlay asked, as he held his cup out.
"For all this is empty land, there aren't that many places the bandits can hide out in," Topar said, drinking down his own tea.
"Shepherds use the high pastures for grazing, and it's turning cold up here now."
"They will have found themselves half a dozen remote campsites," Fressage said, "and they'll shift between them."
Ediard gave the valley to the south a shrewd gaze. The Donsori Mountains weren't the highest range on Querentia, yet the snow caps were creeping downwards again as the last weeks of summer passed away. And the forests that smothered the midslopes were changing colour. The fronds on the dominant Kalkand trees were shading towards beige as they began to contract. Below the tree line, the gentle lower slopes had a yellow tinge. Grass deprived of water during the dry summer months was just starting to taste rain again. Clumps chewed down by terrestrial sheep and cattle along with the roaming flocks of native Chamalans were putting up their last wispy sprouts before the snows came once more. The soil on these remote lands wasn't rich enough to support farms. There were a few isolated cattle stations, but that was all, though with the peaks fencing away clouds, the air was beautifully clear. Visibility stretched for miles.
"If they're to move round unnoticed, it will have to be through the trees," Larby said.
"And the camps will have to be within range of villages,"
Topar agreed. He pointed at the summit of Mount Alvis, at the southeastern end of the valley. "There's a plateau beyond the crest with several villages. Sandmarket is a day's ride beyond that."
"That kind of area is a possible for them," Bolaton agreed, "secluded but in range of Regent Fleet."
Ediard thought they were right, but didn't say anything. He was content with someone else making all the decisions for once. Topar hadn't said how long he was prepared to stay out here trying to track down the bandits, but they were carrying enough food for a fortnight. Once they were back in the saddle, Topar led them onwards, towards Mount Alvis. As before, they clung to the tree line to avoid being spotted. They were assuming the bandits would be using G-eagles and probably dogs. All of them had listened intently to Ediard on the first day when he told them about the tamed fast foxes he'd encountered back in Rulan province. By midday, they were halfway round the mountain slopes, when Topar stopped them. Their G-eagles came flashing down to settle among the treetops. Verini,
who was using the G-Eagle with ordinary vision, had spied two similar G-Eagles in the air above the shallow pass into the plateau country. The pair of them were orbiting high above the stony track, soaring round in a huge circle.
"Definitely keeping watch," Topaz said after they'd watched the G-Eagles for over half an hour. "We'll have to go through the trees to get past them."
Everyone dismounted and began to lead their G-horses into the trees. Edyard went last, sweeping his farsight along the track through the pass to see if he could locate the bandits instructing the G-Eagles. There was no sign of them, not even if he used the counter to concealment, though that wasn't reliable at any distance. They were either on the other side of the pass or hidden behind some thick rock. Their G-Wolves prowled through the forest of calcined trees, using natural senses to scent anyone hidden amid the undergrowth. It was dank and cold under the boughs, as if the tall leaden trunks were somehow caging a winter's mist. The cold soon wormed its way through their jackets and trousers to chill their limbs. Everyone had to use their third hand to ward off low branches and clinging damp fronds. The undergrowth of straggly bushes, stunted by the lack of light, tore at their legs, slowing them further. An endless canopy of scarlet spore cones dripped sap onto their hats, which then dribbled in sluggish rivulets down onto their shoulders. It was late afternoon by the time they reached the far side of the mountain. The plateau was more hospitable than the saddle lands behind. A broad expanse of deciduous forests and long meadows laced with small streams. The peaks all around were low, without snowcaps. Miles away to the northeast, they could see a village, its yellow stone buildings cresting a hillock. Thin strands of smoke wound their way up out of the chimneys. "No wall," Edyard said under his breath. Even now that still startled him. He remembered his surprise on the long journey east with the Barkas caravan, how the fortifications around settlements grew smaller and more dilapidated with every mile they travelled, until finally in Oxfolk province, on the other side of the Ulfson Mountains, they had been abandoned altogether, leaving towns and villages completely exposed to whatever lurked outside their boundary. Only nothing dangerous did lurk there. Not anymore. Not for hundreds of years. With the pass guarded by the G-Eagles far behind them, Topar guided them along the tree line to a steep little valley leading away from the mountain. They hiked down to the stream at the bottom and mounted up again. The G-horses splashed along the stone bed, taking them out onto the plateau. Small martos and blue beech trees grew out of the steep slopes, their roots webbing the big flood boulders, littering the valley. Long whip-like branches waved across the sky above them, providing more cover. Their G-Eagles flew low, barely skimming the uppermost branches, watching for any of their own kind, while the G-Wolves spread out across the boggy meadowland on either side, sniffing the air. As the sun fell below the high, rumpled horizon, they reached one of the many forests sprawled across the plateau. Here the trees weren't so tight, and the ground underfoot was a mat of dead leaves and soft loam. Tall weeds and grass offered no resistance to the G-horses. They made their way to the center where they set up camp. When the first glimmers of the nebulas began to shimmer overhead, Topar dispatched their five night-viewing G-Eagles to see if they could spot the watchers from the pass.
"They're here somewhere," Maxon said intently. "They wouldn't keep a lookout on the pass otherwise."
"Unless they're in the valley on the other side of it," Dinlay pointed out, "and we crossed each other, sometime when we both crept through the trees."
"Ever the optimist," Maxon grunted.
"Practicalist."
"That's not a word."
"Realist," Larby supplied.
"Thank you," Dinlay said.
"They're here on the plateau," Topar said.
Edyard was one of those guiding the G-Eagles, his farsight enabling him to send it over vast swathes of land. It soared up into the air, giving it a broad view of the rolling plateau. Topar had asked him to cover the southeast, where there were forests and narrow gullies and long talus slides spilling out below from fault-line crags. The G-Eagles flew swift and silent, showing him the muted ground, as if he was peering down on a world shrouded by the thickest storm clouds. He saw a dragon pack scampering along a slim gorge like an oily tide. Then they began to churn around a chamelin carcass. Small rusals skipped nimbly up bushes and trees, searching for cones and pods to store for the winter. Trilans wove their low dams across streams, producing wide bogs that proved treacherous to other animals.
Several flocks of chamelans huddled together, those on the outside nervous of whatever skulked through the night. After an hour observing the relatively harmless nocturnal activities of the plateau's wildlife, the G-Eagle caught a flash of motion next to a sprawl of hatlash trees, growing along the marshy banks of a small lake. Something bigger and faster than anything else it had seen that night. The G-Eagle dipped its wing and curved round until it was coasting along several hundred feet above the tops of the hatlash trees. Their trunks were swollen from the lake water, pressed together in a battle for space. The pushing and shoving resulted in the trees leaning at steep angles, producing an interlocked tangle. Perfect cover. The G-Eagle turned again, scouring the swaying treetops for any sign of incongruous movement. It glimpsed something on the third pass and began a tight spiral. Through its eyes, Ediard saw a fast fox slinking along, picking its way through the ragged curtains of weeping boughs. The big predator sped up when it reached a small clearing, where dead trunks were rotting into a rancid pile of fungi. Even so, the G-Eagle clearly saw the collar round its neck. "They're here," Ediard announced quietly, and gifted the G-Eagle's vision to the others.
"Sweet lady," Dinlay muttered.
"I never thought I'd ever see one of those things," Maxon said. Ediard instructed the G-Eagle to back off.
"Why?"
Larby asked. "Its master won't be far away," Ediard explained. "They're not that easy to keep control of, I know. He might farsight our G-Eagle." Sure enough, a few minutes later the fast fox left the hatlash trees. A man was with it, jogging along effortlessly.
"Dear lady," Ediard gasped.
The man was wearing a simple dark tunic and knee-length boots. Two belts were looped over his shoulders, crossing his chest. Slim metal boxes were clipped to it, the kind that held bullets for the rapid-fire gun that was hanging on a third strap. "He's one of them." Shock was making him giddy. His hand started pawing at his chest as he sucked down air.
"Them?" Maxon asked. "You mean the bandits?"
"The ones from Ashwell. He's dressed exactly the same as they were that night. I swear on the lady, he's got to be one of them." He became aware of the nervous glances the others were trading.
"Them,"
he insisted.
"To be expected," Topar said. "They chased me before."
"That's no bandit from the wilds," Larby said.
"Are you okay?" Maxon asked in concern.
Ediard nodded a slow reassurance. Seeing this nemesis return out of his own past was profoundly shocking. "But I've grown since then. This time it's their turn to know fear."
"Do you recognize this actual one?" Dinlay asked.
Ediard returned to the G-Eagle's view. The bird was still gliding higher, keeping level to the bandit and his fast fox. The profile was hardly distinct, but...
"No," Ediard said. "I don't remember any faces. Not really. Though there's one mind I will know forever."
"All right," Topaz said. "Let's follow him. See where he takes us."